Hi, this is Bill Indicky for the Streets.mn podcast, conversations about transportation, public space, and urban design in the Twin Cities. The podcast this week is a conversation with Brendan Slaughterback, longtime Streets.mn writer, sustainability program director for the city of Minneapolis. Brendan has been leading the city's efforts to develop and achieve a set of sustainability metrics, targets aimed at reducing energy use, pollution, and increasing social equity in Minnesota's largest city. We met up a few weeks ago at the One-on-One Bike Studio in the North Loop to talk about the definition of sustainability, how best to reduce energy use, and whether there's such a thing as greenwashing, and we even covered why benchmarks might make sense for cities attempting to decrease their environmental footprint. That was some of the more interesting part of the conversation that I didn't know about. Before I play the tape, please consider giving a donation to support this podcast in streets.mn. It's the end of the year and we're an all-volunteer organization. I think you get where I'm going here. We could use your support. Thanks in advance for your generosity. Hope you enjoy the conversation. Podcast. I'm here with Brendan Slaughterback, who is a Streets.mn founding father and writer. And you're so you've been with us the whole time, and reminded me that we talked, and I interviewed you like how many years ago was that now? Like two or three years.
Over 2 years ago.
I'd completely forgotten about that, so you must have made a good impact on me.
That was when Streets of Men was just a twinkle in our eye, right?
Back it was, then. Yeah. And this is like the over 15 podcasts now I've done. And,
amazing.
Well, anyway, it's a lot. But we're here at the One-on-One Bike Studio on a Wednesday afternoon on a cold day. It's like 0 degrees right now, and the sun is just reaching that twilight moment where it turns blue, sort of, and all the light turns blue, and, the snow just kind of, it's beautiful, but it's also cold.
Very cold.
And you just have to, I'm wearing a lot of layers, personally. You look good, though. You have a nice little tweed coat on.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Trying to stay warm and fashionable, you know.
That's tweed is key. Right. What are you drinking, Brendan?
I'm having a latte here, a skim latte.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Winter warmer.
Let's talk about your job. What is your official position, and how long have you been doing that?
I work for the city of Minneapolis, and my title is sustainability program coordinator. But what that means in reality is that I work on all aspects of sustainability and environmental policy, pretty much for the city of Minneapolis.
So are you responsible for that climate action plan?
Yes. In fact, our office produced that. I was kind of the project manager for developing that plan, kind of facilitating all the public engagement around the plan, and kind of shepherding that whole thing through city council approvals. We're proud of that plan as sort of one of our key aspects of the work that we do for the city.
So are you the first ever sustainability director, coordinator?
No. Our office is an office of two and a half. But the sustainability program has been around for maybe something like 10 years. It was housed in different places previously in the city, but I think the current mayor really was part of bringing it into the administration of the city. So in the city coordinator's office, he kind of was instrumental, I think, in moving sustainability up into an enterprise-wide kind of initiative at the city. So it hasn't been around that long, but I think the idea of sustainability and sort of the environmental focus of the city has probably preceded him for a long time.
Sure. Why do we need a sustainability director?
I think a lot of major cities feel that they need a sustainability program in general just in order to focus on environmental sustainability across the organization and across all policies that the city is working on. So I think the electorate kind of demands it in many of these places, and the elected officials are very interested in making sustainability sort of integral to a lot of the work that they do. So having individuals who are tracking progress and advancing policy at a dedicated place in the city is important, I think.
So the Climate Action Plan came out a couple years ago?
Actually, it was passed just earlier this year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's pretty recent.
Well, yeah.
What's in there? Tell me through the highlights of talking through the highlights of that.
Well, so the Climate Action Plan is based on the city's adopted target to reduce greenhouse gas emissions 15% by 2015 and 30% by 2025. So that's kind of consistent with...
What's the baseline?
The baseline is 2006. And that's consistent with the goals that are adopted by the state of Minnesota as well in the 2007 Next Generation Energy Act. But I think the city views it as our responsibility to contribute to the state's goals, but also the larger kind of global initiative and global responsibility to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So what it does is kind of, first of all, looks at where do our emissions come from. So
I want to actually have you. Do you know that by heart?
I don't know by heart. I can give you sort of the rough breakdown if you want.
Let's do it.
You know, about 60% of it comes from buildings. Primarily heating and cooling of our buildings, lighting of our buildings, the energy used in buildings, basically.
Does that include construction costs for buildings? Because I know that's another big slice.
No, it doesn't include construction. So, we could maybe have a whole podcast about greenhouse gas accounting, but it doesn't include things like the embodied energy in the steel that goes into the building, for example. That's not included. It's what's called a geographic-based inventory. So it kind of looks at what's happening in the city in a given slice of time, for the most part. So it includes that. It includes transportation. So what transportation activities are kind of happening in our boundaries in a given year, cars, trucks. We do include some what we think is our contribution to airport emissions from the use of air travel. Rail, we try to estimate barge traffic. That's about 30%. And then the remainder, which is a smaller slice, is kind of our waste generation and disposal. So that includes solid waste like garbage, but it also includes our sewage, like our waste that we have to treat that goes down the drain.
Does the HERC plant fall into that category?
HERC falls into how we process our solid waste.
Yeah.
So that has an emissions impact.
And that's for anyone who doesn't know, is the Hennepin County garbage burner / power generation facility that's located right next to the baseball stadium.
Right, right.
And predated the baseball stadium.
And that's how we, in Minneapolis, we dispose of, I think, just about all of the waste produced in residential units, 4 units and less, and a large percentage of the waste that comes from commercial and multifamily too, but not all of it.
Does this include also the power plants that are located within the city? Isn't there one of them, the Riverside plant up in Northeast?
Yep, there's a natural gas. Yeah, Riverside's a natural gas fired power plant. It does include those power plants in a sense. The electricity that we buy is produced on a regional grid, so there's actually a way to account for the whole grid's generation and how that contributes to each individual kilowatt hour that we use. So we don't account in saying we're just counting Riverside, because we know our energy comes from lots of other sources too. There's coal plants up in Sherburne County, and there's nuclear facilities down in Monticello, and there's wind turbines, and there's lots of sources. So Xcel actually comes up with a number every year about how carbon intense is our electricity for the upper Midwest, because they have a whole upper Midwest grid, and that's kind of how we account for it.
So you kind of take that number and then multiply by the number of people that live in the city, And then the transportation thing, I was curious about, like, so if someone drives down 94 through Minneapolis, do they get counted as emitting carbon within the city if they don't stop?
They do. And that's kind of, you know, again, this, that's a subject of some debate among the nerdy greenhouse gas accounting community about transportation. There's different methods for accounting for it, right? If somebody drives through our community on the freeway, should we count that as hours per se? And I'm doing the air finger quotes right now for the listeners. And the current method is really based on where we have good data. So MnDOT does a pretty good job of trying to estimate vehicle miles traveled within almost every city boundary in the state. So they have pretty good counts on freeways. They have, you know, also pretty good counts, I think, on state aid and county highways. And then they do some estimation for the more local streets. But there's other ways to do it. Like, for example, there is a method where you take just the trips that are happening just inside your boundary, like someone driving from their house to the grocery store. And then if somebody's commuting into Minneapolis from Lake Elmo, say, this different method would say, well, if you're commuting to work from Lake Elmo, half of that trip distance should be attributable to Lake Elmo, and half of it should be attributable to Minneapolis. The data is sort of available for that. It's not quite ready yet in all areas of the country, so the folks who kind of do this for a living have not, we haven't quite totally gone that way. We did calculate it that way the last time we did it as sort of an extra, but we're not using it as our official number right now.
I think it's one of the challenges of thinking about carbon emissions on a city scale, because so much of this stuff, like you said, is, it's not just global. Well, it is global, right?
Right.
I mean,
right.
And so what you end up doing is kind of offshoring or outsourcing some emissions.
Yeah, exactly.
For example, if they had built this Viking Stadium in Arden Hills, like was proposed, right? You would have been taking all those car trips per year and moving them to a different city, right? And, you know, the Vikings are still going to draw X number of people per year, but they won't be actually within the city boundary. So it would look like a reduction for the city of Minneapolis.
Yeah, there is a definitely a danger of, you know, with the accounting of how do you account for things and losing sight of the fact that this is a global issue and not just looking for strategies that will move, you know, emission sources outside of the city. And that's, I think that's, transportation is one example of that, where just, it's hard to count those things, but it's also a jurisdictional, authority issue, right? You know, Minneapolis doesn't necessarily control all the transportation is a regional system.
It barely controls any of the transportation.
Right. I mean, our effect is, I don't know, limited depending on who you talk to, but most of the people who work in Minneapolis, you know, we have a lot of people who live and work in Minneapolis, but we have maybe an equal number that live outside the city and come into the city to work, or they come here to shop, or you know, go to First Avenue or whatever they do. But you could argue that greenhouse gases from our transportation system really need to be addressed at the regional level or the state level, because we're, especially as a core city, we don't have jurisdiction over all that. And there's a similar issue with your idea of the jurisdictional accounting about food and goods and services. So a lot of places, there was a great article by Dan Haugen, I don't know if you read him, from Midwest Energy News, talking about Scandinavia and how progressive they are on greenhouse gas emissions. And they've done so much to reduce their emissions, and many of the countries are almost carbon free because they, you know, are producing their energy from sources that don't emit greenhouse gases. But if you look at their consumption patterns, they're actually, you know, some of them are like Denmark, I think in the article was saying it's, they're actually higher than the U.S. per capita. And so they're responsible for greenhouse gases from what they consume. It's just that those emissions are happening outside their boundaries.
I read some of these articles all the time. Not that one that you're referencing, but it was a claim that
the average refrigerator in the United States emits as much carbon as like the average Ethiopian person, right?
Right.
Or something like that. But the scale is so different for people in the global north, like Denmark, versus people in the global south, like Ethiopia or like a country, right?
Right.
India, it doesn't matter. And then I thought about my my parents who have like four refrigerators and just bought one, and like, and, you know, they're only two people. And I, you know, it's embarrassing, and it's, but in a certain sense, just having money and having a per capita income of whatever it is, $40,000 a year, is going to mean that you are responsible for a lot of carbon emissions, where you live.
Right, and I think that's some of the things that the folks who think about this a lot is struggle with is, can we, you know, as a state, we actually have seen our GDP. Detach from energy consumption. So while our energy, you know, per capita or however you measure it, has stayed flat for a while, actually.
How long?
You know, I'd have to go back and look, but I think it's probably since the mid-2000s or maybe a little bit earlier than that. But we've actually sort of separated a GDP from total energy use. Can we get to a place where we're increasing the however you want to measure quality of life without simultaneously continuing to increase either energy consumption or greenhouse gases? And maybe we can just get our energy from a different source, or maybe we have to actually reduce how much energy we use. As a country, we have been getting more energy efficient, you know, per unit of GDP. I think we're using less energy to achieve that, but it's certainly not getting us where we need to go in terms of carbon goals.
I mean, the U.S. is still one of the most energy-intensive, wasteful countries. Not intensive, but energy-hogging countries in the world per capita, right?
Yes, so yes.
Don't have any children, is right? Isn't that the answer? No.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if this is the podcast for that, to talk about that. But
I guess my question was about how, you know, given the complexity of thinking about energy and its relationship to everyday life, how easy or difficult is it to like get caught up in this vast web of interconnectivity versus trying to focus on your one job, which is Minneapolis and the policies that we have here in this one city of 380,000 people?
I mean, that's a good question. It's sort of always a challenge to not get overwhelmed by the globalness of some of these topics, if that's what your charge is to do is. But I think then what we have to do at the city in our office is sort of look at what are those levers that we can try to pull at the city level that will have like a bigger impact. And maybe that's local ordinances, or maybe that's sort of partnerships that we can establish with other communities, or maybe that's work we can do at the state level to kind of move the dial a little bit. But I think we're certainly not going to solve all the problems ourselves.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
How is Minneapolis doing according to these own metrics then about these 15% by 2015? That's only 2 years away, buddy.
Yeah, that's 2 years away. Well, the numbers for 2012 are looking encouraging. I think since 2006, we're down about, I just looked at this morning. I think the number is 6.5% from 2006 to 2011, and it's greater than that for 2012. And a big piece of that is the change in emissions from electricity. So Xcel is actually getting cleaner every year, most years, because of some voluntary actions they've taken, but also because of obviously the state mandate on how much energy they get from renewable sources.
Tell me about that for a second. So they passed, I think it was 10 years ago or
2007. So? Yeah, they passed a mandate for utilities in Minnesota about how much renewable energy they need to have. And I think right now it sits for Xcel, I think it's 31.5% by 2020 or 2025. So they're kind of required to report and mandate on that every year. And there's also a requirement that they they kind of strive to achieve a 1.5% energy efficiency number every year as well. So they look at
reduction in consumption.
Not a total reduction, but they sort of look at what would we otherwise have consumed if we hadn't done certain activities to encourage energy efficiency. So they actually, that's, for example, if you have ever gotten a rebate on your water heater or your furnace or something like that, that's sort of some of their activities to help encourage energy efficiency. And there was a big report on that recently that those measures have saved, saved Minnesotans, millions of dollars in energy costs. But the state as a whole is actually kind of far from our 2015 goals. It doesn't look like, without some stupendous effort or economic collapse, that we're gonna hit that 2015 target.
Let's not wish for the latter.
No, certainly not. But yeah, so Minneapolis. I mean, we're doing okay. I think sustainability we view as sort of a continuous process and not like we're ever done, but a lot of the factors again are outside of our control. But I think we do want to focus on the things we can do locally, like promoting energy efficiency, looking at our relationships with our utilities a little bit more, and seeing how can we try to promote energy efficiency and renewable energy a little bit more than we've done in the past.
So is the energy options plan kind of an example of that?
Well, that was, yeah, certainly that's like a community-based effort to try to look at how we can get more different outcomes from our energy system, I guess. And I think there was lots of discussion that at the city level. The city is currently undertaking a energy pathways study, which is looking at all kinds of options, including municipalization as one of them, but there are other pathways as well to kind of look at what do we need to do in our current regulatory structure and to see how we might advance some of these goals. And that's going to come out in February, so stay tuned for that. You'll probably be interested to read that.
So you said that XL has changed its a ratio of green energy to fossil fuels, right?
Right.
Break that down. Is that, what kind of power are we talking about?
Oh, now you're testing my memory.
You're doing really well on these details, by the way. I'm very impressed.
You know, we still get Minnesota, the upper, I think they talk about it as their upper Midwest grid, but, we still get a significant portion of our electricity is generated by coal. But we're getting, in terms of XL at least, and there's many other utilities in Minnesota, but in terms of XL, they're really getting up there in terms of renewable capacity. And again, they'll be around 30% by something like 2020.
Is that mostly wind power, hydropower? Those two.
It's a little bit of hydro. Yeah, those are the two big ones. But mostly wind. They don't have there's not a really measurable amount of solar energy in Minnesota, so it's mostly wind power. And I've even seen some presentations by them that they say it's at certain times of day or night. It's probably at night actually. They are actually getting upwards of 40% of the region's energy from wind power. So it's only certain hours of the day, but when the wind is blowing the hardest and there's probably like the lowest load, they're really getting up there.
And
in terms
where
of
are these wind turbines?
Well, they have contracts with people all over the place. So it's Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, maybe even other states. But and then the hydropower, I think a lot of it is from Canada. They have contracts with folks in Manitoba to get that. And then we have our, Xcel owns its own natural gas, coal, and nuclear plants throughout the region.
Right.
Yeah.
And I thought this was a good opportunity to talk to you about your solar installation that you've been blogging about. I'm curious about when you
sort
put
of
that
embarrassed
up
that I put that on my blog.
Well, it's cute.
Cute,
no,
yeah.
I don't know.
That's what I was going for.
No, it's awesome.
Like a button.
I should say awesome. I mean, but it is cute too. Like, it's a little panel. you know.
It's two panels now, Bill.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I've doubled the size.
Well, so when did you put that up, and how's it going? And what have you learned from that? And
well,
how big is it, and how many watts and stuff?
You know, I just saw the I just got really curious about it. I mostly just talk about policy all day in my job, and at least attempt to be sort of hands-on when I can. So I was really curious to just learn about. I started reading other people's blogs and other books about, like, you know, doing it yourself with solar. And it's actually not, you know, it's not too terribly complicated a technology to understand. So I felt like I could. I started looking at the pieces and the costs, and I felt like I could try to build some, like, very small but you know, doable thing in my own backyard and figure out how all the pieces work. So mostly it's been it's certainly not a revenue generator. It's more like what
is
I would
an electricity generator at least.
Oh yeah, it generates electricity, but
oh,
but it's more of like a hobby and a way for me to learn about how all the components of solar work. And
so you need to have a panel, and then you need to have some sort of transformer or something like that?
Well, you need to, I mean, there's two kinds. You can either have it where your solar panels are feeding.
Or battery, right?
Yeah. Either your panels are feeding into the electricity grid, which requires you to, you know, the utility kind of, you have to have an agreement with them that you can feed things back into the grid. And that requires them to be comfortable that you have a safe and efficient system, which is, you know, I haven't gotten to that level of detail yet. But then the other piece is you can just have it off grid, right? So it can just be fed into a battery, and then for whatever your purposes are, you pull power from the battery. So I mean, the components are the panel. You need to have a charge controller, which is just a little box basically that takes the energy from the panel and charges the battery. And batteries are kind of a fickle thing, so they have computer algorithms that kind of determine what the best way to charge the battery is.
Why are batteries so fickle?
I don't know. I mean, they don't like to. You can't charge them. You can't overcharge them, right? Because you'll burn them up. And if they're the panel kind of produces power at its one particular level, depending on how the sunlight is, and the battery wants it only at another particular level. So this little box kind of is the intermediary between those two things. So, and then batteries don't like to be, you know, at least lead acid, you don't want to discharge them more than 50% many times, unless you'll kind of kill them
kind
off.
Kind of like my computer right here that's not plugged in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Hopefully our podcast is saved. Yeah, and then you have to have a little box to kind of invert the power. So, you know, battery power is DC, right, which is direct current. And everything in your house uses AC, so
that's
you have
that
to have
Tesla thing. You know?
Yeah, exactly. And there's lots of once you start to learn about this, you start to actually realize that maybe we'd be better off having DC houses because we're converting to you know, most of the things you plug in now, like your computer and this microphone and everything, actually run on DC power, but they have a little wall wart that you plug in, and what that's doing is it's converting it from AC to DC to feed the device. Mm-hmm. And so we're actually
suck up a lot of energy. Those
yeah, we're actually wasting energy to convert from DC to AC and then back from AC to DC. So, yeah.
Well, that's
this is all the stuff you learn when you get into this. Like,
this is actually one of the things I think about changing behavior and sustainability in general, and because I'm also thinking about behavior change as a, you know, how do people develop
right.
more sustainable habits. And one of the things that's really useful is to just be more in touch with your resource base, right? With the electricity that you use. Or gardening is the same way. So
right.
Growing your own garden isn't really going to solve the world's problems. But it does get your hands dirty, and you realize what it takes to make a zucchini out of the earth, right?
Right.
And
right.
and you're actually invested in you know, hands-on, like, learning about that process. And I think that changes how you look at food. And maybe
yeah.
doing that with electricity is the same kind of thing. Like, it changes how you look. And that sort of change in your mentality is really important. And I think it's hard to quantify.
Right.
But it's that's how people develop better habits in terms of how they live.
Yeah, I think that idea is true, that experience really teaches you something. I mean, when I'm working with a battery, for example, I'm thinking about, well, what can I power with this thing? Well, I can power more if it's more energy efficient, right? And so I think about, like, you know, what light bulbs do I have in my house? And if I only have a finite amount of electricity in this battery, you know, I can do certain things with it. But if my what I'm plugging into is more efficient, then I can do more stuff, you know. So I think that's true. And having people, I think the Minneapolis example where you had all these community members sort of rallying around this idea of a municipal utility and talking about that. I mean, even if the outcome isn't a municipal utility, what you've done too is you have a lot of people really interested in energy, and they end up learning a whole bunch about, well, how does our energy system actually work, and where does our power come from, and who makes the decisions about that those resources. And my hope is that as we continue down that path, we can have a lot more residents really engaged in that conversation. And so many people, I think, approach that system as, well, it's, you know, I can flip on a light switch and it works, right? And if it doesn't work, then I have to call someone. But I don't really care how much I use, because for most people, it's not a significant part of their bills that they pay, and it's just there, and it's just sort of in the background, and they're not thinking about where it's coming from. Right. So, yeah. That was probably too long of an answer.
No, it's perfect. I'm curious also, what can you power with your two panels? How many watts, whatever, is your panels?
Well, it's only 200 watts total. So, you know, it's really...
A blender? No, you probably can't do a blender.
Well, you could power a blender, but not for very long.
Okay.
I use it for a couple lights and powering like sort of a home stereo system and things like that.
Does music sound better when the electricity is generated from
Well, to
house?
My ears, it sounds better, but I don't know. It's the idea is to make it sound the same, you know, have equal quality. But
AC/DC, you should play that on there.
Oh yeah, exactly. I don't think I've played that since. I should try that and see what happens. So it's not a huge amount, but. I have grand plans for expansion in the future, and we'll see if those come to fruition where I could, you know, power a quarter of my household needs or something like that. But we'll see. We'll see where that goes.
Well, good luck. I'm looking forward to hearing about that.
Yeah.
Well, one of the questions I asked you...
It won't be cute anymore. It'll be more...
terrible?
Yeah, terrible. Yeah.
Good God, yeah. What have I wrought?
Right, exactly. Say. Exactly.
You know, cool. that's, you know, power. But I asked you what your definition of sustainability was, or what the city's... I asked you what the city's definition of sustainability is. Maybe it's different from your own personal one.
In an email, you asked me that.
Yeah.
For the listeners.
Right.
Yeah.
What is the official definition, or how does the city of Minneapolis conceive of it? Who and what and for how long? Those are the dynamics here.
Good questions. I think the city, if we have an official, actual definition, it has to do with sort of, you know, making decisions in the way that preserve the ability of future generations to kind of meet their needs as well. And the city, in addition to that, we've kind of adopted this sort of what many people are probably familiar with, like the triple bottom line, or sort of the three-legged stool of sustainability. So not just looking at the environment, but looking at social equity, so kind of the people leg of the stool, and then the economic sustainability. So, and Minneapolis, I think, approaches it not so much from a definitional standpoint, but sort of a measurement. So we try to like have a lot of metrics around how we're doing. And view it as sort of this continuous process. So we have a whole suite of 26 like topics, and then we have lots.
I've read all 26 of those.
You have?
Yeah, I have. No, I went through that green report or whatever it's called. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And it was, but it was a couple years ago, and I forgot what they all said.
So every year under the 26, there's even each one has, you know, one, two, or three metrics maybe, and then we kind of track progress on those every year. So they deal with everything from, you know, teen pregnancy to stormwater quality. And so we're looking at and climate change and miles of bikeway. And so we're looking at sort of what we think is sort of a good way to measure sustainability at an urban scale. But we're kind of refining those, kind of constantly refining those metrics and how we define that.
Is that metric-based approach pretty standard, or how did you come up with that?
I think for a lot of cities, it's becoming standard. Before I worked for the city, I think Minneapolis was one of the very first cities to kind of really try to put some metrics on sustainability and really measure what that means. But I think you'll find it's becoming very common among many cities to try to establish a set of metrics and measure outcomes like that. And a lot of them are similar. They deal with similar topics.
It's kind of refreshingly non-philosophical in a way. Like, it's like, well, we don't know what sustainability is, but we know these 26 things are important to it.
Right.
And we're going to measure those and track those and work on these 26 things, like teen pregnancy and unemployment and biking and whatever they all are.
Right, and that's part of what's built into the city system, is that every 2 years we say we're gonna look at the whole set of metrics and say to ourselves and to our stakeholders, are these the right set of metrics? And then continue to refine those. So not only how are we doing on them, but are we even measuring the right things? Because I think we'll find different data sources are available, and we can actually start measuring something we couldn't measure in the past, or different things become more important than they were in the past. So
yeah, how's that going? Are there certain sorts of kinds of metrics that are easier to tackle and others that are challenging, and why?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, for example, you know, we have a pretty good sense of like energy use. Like the utilities can actually track fairly well, and we can get data from them on like how much energy we use. But something like actually, you think a metrics rich place would be transportation, but really, how do you really determine are we doing the right thing for transportation? You can look at sort of commuter mode share, but that really doesn't tell you the whole story about what people are doing in their non-work trips, you know. So the city did start a number of years ago, like a bike count and pedestrian count.
Yeah, I participated in that this last
year.
Yeah,
right. But that's one day of the year, you know, and it can change a lot. If the weather's good, then the count is always better than if the weather is bad. And then how do we really tell... you know, for like transit usage, for example, people coming into downtown is one metric, but how are people moving around the city? And then it's all about land use too, right? Like, so should we move to something more like an accessibility matrix or some metrics of how people can access destinations or something? So it's it continues to be refined. And there's other things that are even more amorphous, like stormwater is really tricky. How do you, you know, there's quantity, there's quality, there's sort of like you get into the water bodies and you think about invasive species, but and all water sort of, you know, are we impacting someone downstream from us too? And so there, it gets really tricky about how do you really tell if you're doing as much as you should be doing in that area. So it's tough.
Do you think there's like slices of the pie that Minneapolis isn't really doing that other places are?
Let's see. I think some of our challenges probably, you know, since we're talking about the sustainability as like the triple bottom line, I think, you know, Minnesota and Minneapolis too have like very big disparities in our community. Like we perform well on unemployment rates overall, but we have some of the largest disparities in the country in terms of race in employment, and those kinds of disparities show up in all kinds of other health you know, measures of health and measures of income and measures of participation in the public process and things like that. And so to to get to that full accounting of sustainability or resiliency or whatever you want to call vibrancy of the city, I think we need to address those. That's going to be a challenge, certainly.
It's funny that you you said vibrancy and resiliency and sustainability just now, which are three buzzwords, I should say, or whatever. You know, those are three.
What was that term from the paper? Empty.
Empty signifier.
Empty signifier.
Well,
right. Right.
You know, it's a fuzzy concept, I guess. Yeah. Is a better. That's another term from this paper I sent you, which you know. But what is the connection between social equity and environmental sustainability? I guess that's the question I have for you.
Well, I think.
Do we need one to have the other?
I guess it depends on how you define it, but I think from the city's perspective, we do need to have that connection made because there are certain communities who face disproportionate impacts from environmental pollution, for example. There are people who just have less access to the process to make decisions or are underrepresented in that process to make decisions. So if we're going to have sustainability, you know, keep our community healthy environmentally and from a human perspective in the long term, I think that from the city's perspective, we do need to have those connected together.
Yeah.
Is that too dodgy of an answer for
well,
you?
Well, no, it's about the right amount of dodginess. Like, because it is tricky to make that argument sometimes. So you can be living in a greener neighborhood, you know, green literally in the sense there's a lot of gardens and trees and backyards and believe yourself to be leading a sustainable lifestyle. Because let's say you drive a Prius and walk everywhere and have a garden and,
right.
you know, and there's
right.
a bird feeder and you walk around the lake.
Right.
I'm curious about why that's not sustainable if another whole part of your city has a wholly different kind of quality of life or social problems.
Well, I guess that sort of goes to, you know, the city as a whole. We're looking at these metrics as a whole, right? I mean, we want to make sure that that we're serving all of the city, and even something as simple as tree canopy cover, for example, is vastly different in different parts of the neighborhood in Minneapolis. We have very good tree canopy coverage, but if you look at areas that are, you know, disproportionately communities of color, tends to correspond with lower tree canopy coverage.
That's why that tornado going through North Minneapolis was doubly tragic because
it was
just sad to go there like a couple days after and see all these the only giant trees they have and they're all.
Right,
just uprooted.
Right. But tree canopy coverage is associated with all kinds of benefits around not just things like stormwater and shading your buildings for energy efficiency, but also for just, you know, there's studies on, you know, just viewing green things actually has positive impact on your health. And so if we're thinking about the city as a whole, you know, we can't ignore the disparities between neighborhoods in those circumstances.
And parks and
right.
Okay, greenwashing. Let's talk about greenwashing for a second.
Okay.
That one of the
where are you going with
critiques,
this one?
Well, I don't know. One of the critiques of sustainability that
is this why you invited
in my
me here,
geography
Bill?
Department to grill you. Well. I'm not, no, it's that sustainability is often like a buzzword used to, you know, you see it a lot. You see it all over the place.
Right.
Just like vibrancy and what was the other, resilience.
Right.
Like these, you know, you throw it into.
I'll throw out like three or four more before the podcast is over.
Do you have three more? Wow.
Trying to think of them now.
But like, you know, you build a project that maybe doesn't solve some of these broader equity or long-term sustainability issues, but if you put a green roof on it or if you put a bike rack in front of it, that means it's sustainable. So,
yeah, right.
I don't know. How do you think about that kind of, whether something is really sustainable or just has the facade of being sustainable?
Yeah. Well, from a city level, I think that's like the key importance of the citywide metrics, right, and getting those right, is that We're not just doing press releases about, look at this cool thing that we built. Like, we built a LEED Platinum maintenance facility, which the city has, but that's not the end of our sustainability conversation. You know, trying to measure sustainability on a citywide basis through a number of metrics is really how we should look at it, and not, you know, and that's kind of how we try to avoid greenwashing, to say, how do we measure what we're actually doing and what we're actually accomplishing?
Actually, that's a really convincing answer.
Good. Well, I hope so. Yeah. But that, I think that's why so many cities are going this way, is to really show people, what does this mean and how are we going to get there? And also just from an organizational standpoint, it's, you know, sustainability is such a diverse topic that you do have to slice it up and say, okay, what are we going to work on in this area? You know, how are we going to, what does that mean? Well, part of it is energy efficiency. And how are we going to go about doing energy efficiency? Well, that's, you have to slice it up and try to get to those doable things that you can actually try to work on. So part of it's just organizational, performance management.
Okay, the last topic was about urban design and what role that plays in this conversation. You had said land use once, and it just gets really nebulous. I think you did a post a while ago about LEED ND. So thinking about LEED, not just in terms of, did you do that one? LEED neighborhood design?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I've done it on Streets of Men, but certainly I've done a lot on my own. Yeah, net density. I've done a lot about LEED ND.
Yeah. Which is an idea that it's not just the building that has to be sustainable, it's how it's located and,
right,
and connected to the spaces around it that is,
right,
important in,
right,
terms of the transportation effects especially.
Right, right. So, yeah, and that's also interrelated with like regional growth. How does that happen? I mean, urban design, I guess it depends where how you want to define that, but it is important to sustainability. I think, you know, through just the basic things that you think about, like is a space inviting and physically accessible to people who want to walk and bike rather than drive a car, for example. That's important, and then it goes on. That sort of very site-specific stuff, and then it goes all the way up to like regional planning. Like, how are we going to, if we're going to plan for kind of an auto-dependent region, then that's probably what we're going to get. So, on the whole spectrum of issues, I think urban design and land use are critically important too.
Do you have any advice for planners for how to use sustainability in a smart, effective way?
Well, I guess that seems like a loaded question to me, because some planners would not like to use the term sustainability, depending on what community they're working in.
Why not?
Well, because it's sort of a buzzword that has a lot of negative connotations around it. But
really, I think it's like a nice, friendly teddy bear of a word.
Well, you need to spend more time outside of Minneapolis and St. Paul. And
I did go to a community meeting with the MnDOT and Met Council chair yesterday, and some folks from Woodbury were in the front row with signs complaining about transit. And they were very adamant.
Right. And that's Woodbury. You should go out to Ramsey or somewhere on the real fringe of the metro. You'd be surprised about people's thoughts on the word sustainability. But I think it's sort of I think you do have to look at what the if you're a planner working in a city, you have to look at the values of the city, right, and the elected officials. And there's not very many people that want polluted water and unbreathable air. I mean, those are sort of the basics, right? So you can start with that. But
do you think there's like an inherent negative critique of talking about sustainability, that you're inherently saying that your lifestyle right now is not sustainable? That's why we need to talk about sustainability, right?
I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, I guess there probably is a little bit of that, that there's an implication that we're, that we've been doing something wrong. And I think a lot of people would agree that we are, certainly in terms of specific items like climate change, for example. You know, I would say that clearly there's impacts that we're having or going to have into the future. And so the systems that we have in place now are not the ones that are really going to serve us well in the long term. So that's probably sort of a natural, that's one of the reasons I think why you have the conflict that you do around all kinds of environmental issues, is that if you tell someone that they're doing something wrong, then that sort of puts up automatic barriers, right, to even having a discussion about it. Some people and in the literature and things like that have talked about, you know, creating a positive message around a vision, you know, like instead of talking about what's wrong, you talk about a desired future condition, you know, and it's a lot better to rally people around a desired future condition than it is to say what you're doing now is bad and you know, you should be punished for that. So, and there's also a lot of behavioral research around like peer pressure and thinking about how people, you know, as humans, we're sort of we're still very social animals that like to be part of groups. And so if we view a group of people doing something and we naturally kind of think, well, I'd like to be part of that in-group, or yeah, my identity is tied to being part of this group, or my identity is tied to being not part of that group, that's a very powerful motivator for people. So
that's one of the reasons I like this bike shop so much. I feel like part of this group, and I don't feel like such a weird loser for riding a bike around the city, because I come here and there's people just like me, and we can all hang out and look at bikes and talk about how it sucks to bike in the winter.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's just that's true. But on a broader, you know, the challenge is that so many of these so-called sustainability topics are really regional and national in scope and global in scope, that it's hard to build like shared identities at those scales, right?
Yeah, that's why the city is so important, because that's where you really identify with like a specific community. Like the word community, community, that means who you live with, right?
Right. Yeah, and it can't. A lot of cities are making progress at doing it at the city level, I think, because it's a small enough scale that you can have a sense of shared, you know, shared identity and kind of shared vision around things.
What's like the leader? Which city is kind of leading the way on this?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it depends on the topic, but there's lots of communities doing great stuff. Like, obviously, I think of Portland a lot, but Seattle, Chicago, New York City to some extent, although I don't know that the vision is always completely shared by all the residents as much. But Boulder, Colorado, yeah. Denver, Austin, Texas, I think.
That's the usual suspects. You just named all of them.
Yeah, exactly. I'm trying to think of any place with a
non-sustainability coordinators.
I wouldn't call it a secret society, but we do definitely talk to each other a lot. At least the ones from some of the more major cities across North America. We do talk to each other and compare notes, just like any other kind of professional organization where you would kind of share stories and best practices and things like that.
Do you feel guilty when you fly to a sustainability conference?
I do. Yeah, sometimes I feel guilty. I mean, I think about aviation is such a major source. So
I saw someone did an.
We do a lot of conference calling.
Okay, good. But someone did like an analysis of like professors at the U, and looking at their carbon footprints.
Yeah.
And it was like the majority of their carbon footprint was just flights to various events and things.
Yeah.
And it was like, you can live right next to campus in Prospect Park and walk to work every day, but if you fly all
right.
over the place.
Right.
I'm just picking that as an example. Nobody in mind.
Nobody we know matches that description, right? No Streets of Men writers.
But anyway, that was just the one study was like about flights. And,
yeah.
And those, that's kind of...
But you'll be the academic to change that, right?
Well, yeah.
You'll lead the new peer group of academics who will reject that. No, I don't know. Some of that's... That's what the job is
yeah.
to a certain extent, and you can't succeed in academia if you don't participate in those things.
Right.
But that might be a place where we need some technological solutions, so like, you know, meeting in person and just being more connected globally, but, you know, not necessarily having to fly to where somebody lives to experience that. So
we're I'm obviously running out of things to ask you. Is there something I forgot to talk about here, Brandon? Have we covered the sustainability question in Minneapolis?
I think we have. I don't know. We've had a pretty good conversation, I think. I'm trying to think about any other issues. You can edit out all the
I have a crazy question for you.
Okay.
What if you were, like, you know, given super political powers over the city? Like, what would be, like, the one or two changes you would make that would really push the...
See, that's a loaded question because I, you know... work with all of these elected officials all the time, so I...
it's hard to say, but I know you've expressed frustration to me in the past that our pace of change isn't fast enough.
Well, yeah, in terms of... I think that probably was that comment in the sense of, like, globally in terms of climate change, or...
Yeah. You know, because it is... I mean, you're not alone in sharing that frustration... the guy in the last climate conference from the Philippines who went on a hunger strike because nothing was happening.
Right. Yeah. I think that's an issue of. I think there's a lot of attention and support for that, for action at the Minneapolis level in particular, and I don't know if I was, you know, an elected official. Obviously, you've got like 100 different things that you're trying to do, but. I think the city is actually, in the next year or two, I think we will be really taking more aggressive action on those items. But I guess I would just fall back on, like, blaming other levels of government. Like, the state should do more than we should do. But we certainly could have, like we were talking about, the kind of group dynamics and social norms, like... you know, people in the city sort of organizing to affect changes to the to our energy system is good in the sense that we're educating people about those things. And I don't know, I'm avoiding your question, but I don't know what else to say about it. I'm trying to think if I had super political powers.
You don't have to answer that.
I don't know. Just given, yeah, I don't know. I won't say anymore. Given my where I'm at.
Yeah,
but
yeah. Cool. Well, thanks for talking to me, Brandon. This is great. And is it weird to talk about global warming in the January or December freeze or whatever we're in now? Is that like? People
well, no, you. I, you know, people, yeah, lots of people make that comment, but it's, you know, weather is different than climate, right, is the typical response. 2012 was the hottest year on record in the continental United States, like, by a huge margin. It blew everything else out of the water, and that was the same for Minnesota and Minneapolis in particular. It was the hottest year ever recorded, going back to the 1800s. So I don't, you know... Winter's going to be cold for a long time to come, but that doesn't mean anything about climate change.
Great. Well, thanks for talking to me.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening.
listening to the Streets.mn podcast. If you have any feedback or ideas, you can comment on Streets.mn, on Twitter @StreetsMN, or email me at blindicky@gmail.com. So long from St. Paul.